So here's where we're at on as far as the outline of the book. We, as you can tell by the outline, we're getting really, really near the end. And as I said, we're going to cover 32, 33, 34, and then BJ will cover the last three next week. So we're going to jump right in. Again, if you need a handout, they are in the back on the podium. Just a couple of things about this young man by the name of Elihu you're going to find as we get in here is he is apparently much younger than the others. He also, for his age, displays quite a bit of wisdom. But we're going to find, like the other three friends, he starts trying to come up with some way to accuse Job of something. Now, a lot of what his approach is very different. His approach is not to make false accusations. His approach is to catch Job in his own words on earlier things that he has said. And Job has said some things that we pointed out along the way that were pretty pointed at God, saying God had to be behind all of these activities. And so he's going to jump on several things like that and really kind of hold Job's feet to the fire on his previous words. So we have the introduction, and I'm going to ask BJ, if he would, to read 32 in its entirety, verses 1 through 22, and then we'll start going down through the verses.
So these three men ceased to answer Job because he was righteous in his own eyes. Then Elihu, the son of Barachel, the Buzite, of the family of Ram, burned with anger. He burned with anger at Job because he justified himself rather than God. He burned with anger at Job's three friends because they found no answer, although they had declared Job to be in the wrong. Now Elihu had waited to speak to Job because they were older than he. And when Elihu saw that there was no answer in the mouth of these three men, he burned with anger. And Elihu, the son of Barachel the Buzite, answered and said, I am young in years, and you are aged. Therefore I was timid and afraid to declare my opinion to you. I said, let days speak and many years teach wisdom. But it is the spirit in man, the breath of the Almighty, that makes him understand. It is not the old who are wise, nor the aged who understand what is right. Therefore I say, listen to me, let me also declare my opinion. Behold, I waited for your words, and I listened for your wise sayings, while you searched out what to say. I gave you my attention, and behold, there was none among you who refuted Job or who answered his words. Beware lest you say, we have found wisdom, God may vanquish him, not a man. He has not directed his words against me, and I will not answer him with your speeches. They are dismayed, they answer no more. They have not a word to say. And shall I wait because they do not speak, because they stand there and answer no more? I also will answer with my share. And I also will declare my opinion, for I am full of words. The spirit within me constrains me. Behold, my belly is like wine that has no vent, like new wineskins ready to burst. I must speak that I may find relief. I must open my lips and answer. I will not show partiality to any man or use flattery towards any person, for I do not know how to flatter, else my maker would soon take me away.
Okay. Thank you, BJ. A number of things as we start chapter 32 is the question we might ask, well, who is this young man, Elihu, and why was he there? We don't really know answers to either of those questions, but we do know the answer to the third one. Was he there the entire time? We will find as we go through tonight and also next Wednesday, he continually refers back to things that Job said very early at the beginning. So the answer is, yes, he was probably there the entire time along with several others. Most commentaries say that he was probably from a small Arabian tribe or clan. And again, it can be assumed he was present from the beginning because he restates a lot of Job's comments. And his wrath or his strong displeasure really was kindled, he says here, as BJ read for us, because of a few things. First of all, he felt Job had justified himself at the expense of God's honor. Remember, a lot of times Job came back and said, this has got to be from the hand of God. And so he didn't feel Job was right in pointing at God. He felt Job was righteous in his own eyes. He felt wrath because the three friends of Job had condemned Job, but they had no proof. They had absolutely no answer. He was also upset because the three friends had made many false assumptions that also were not true. And he was also somewhat indignant because there was no answer from the three friends. They were silenced by Job. They had nothing more to say, no more accusations to make. Down in verse number 6, he talks about the young and the very old. And so it's very evident that whatever his age as a young man, he's much older than the three friends and much older than Job. And thus he as a youth would have to wait his turn to speak. I'm sorry, what? Oh, did I say older? I'm sorry. Much younger. He was much younger than the three friends and much younger than Job, and thus he had to wait his turn to speak. There was always a pecking order in these kinds of things, and so he had to sit by and listen to all these conversations and these debates as they went in the various cycles. Verses 7 and 8, he really is expressing disappointment in Job and his three friends because frankly, he states he expected more wisdom from them. Because of their great age, he thought they would have more insight and more understanding about life and sufferings and the things that Job was facing. And so he's very, very disappointed. In verses 9 and 10, he uses the word great, and he's talking about chief or captain. And basically what the commentators say he's expressing here in verses 9 and 10 is that he appears shocked that having such a high place in society as these three friends and Job and having great age, that did not always bring about wisdom and understanding in the exercise of justice. And so he's very let down that the three friends, that Job didn't have some better answers than what came out of the cycles of debate. And he refers to being there, verses 11, 12, he says, I waited, I listened, I attended, and he says, you guys searched and debated and talked and you came up with nothing. And so basically his charge here is they really failed to convict Job by convicting him of any sins that they had charged against him, and they failed to refute Job's claims. So he's very disappointed. He tells the three that they could not vanquish Job by means of their own wisdom, and that his desire, and this is where he has a different approach than the three friends, his desire is not to vanquish or defeat Job, but he wants to befriend him and show him his error and bring him to repentance. And that's going to come out more tonight and also next week when BJ gets the last three chapters. But that's his desire. He doesn't want to vanquish him. He wants to bring him to repentance and get back in a right relationship with God. And frankly, Elihu shows some maturity, quite mature for his young age. Okay, Marvin and then BJ.
Just for the setting, so I understand it right, how do you understand the setting? Was there a group of people here making accusations, or did people come one by one, and he was listening, or was it like these three people and just him there?
We only know what the scripture reveals, and we know for sure that apparently Elihu for sure was there, and we know the three friends were there. And more than that, I can't say whether there were some from society that were sitting there, maybe some of the other princes or nobles. I don't know. That would be going beyond what we know. We know that the three friends were there and Job was there. We know that Elihu refers to things that were said much earlier, so we know he was there. But just frankly, we just don't know beyond that. BJ, you had a thought?
Well, I was just going to say, Elihu brings out a good point. When we're discussing things with people, are we trying to win the argument or win the soul?
Right.
And though Elihu might not, say everything correctly, just like we might not say everything correctly or understand everything correctly, a lot of times we get caught up in trying to win the argument, and so what? You might win the argument, them further away from Christ because of the way in which you pursued that and spoke to them. We need to be not quarrelsome, but kind to everyone, and patient, and able to teach. And in doing so, the goal is repentance, as Paul tells Timothy. And so I think Elihu is just a good example of that.
Yeah, he's not trying, you've heard the expression, I think you mentioned, BJ, you can win the battle but lose the war. And, you can win an argument with somebody, but you're trying to convert their soul. Elihu's approach is very mature for a young man. He wants honestly to show Job where he thinks Job has erred and wants Job to get back in a right relationship with God. To get back to Marvin's first question, though, several commentators have, and it's all over the board, but a lot of them feel that there was probably always a small cohort of people there during this whole thing. You got to remember, Job really was almost like superstar, rock star status when he, before everything, he lost everything. He was the most wise man of the East. And, you know, men bowed to him. Men were silent. You know, princes tipped their heads and bowed down. And, you know, he was very, very well-respected man in society. So a lot of commentators believe there was some kind of a cohort of people there the whole time. But for me to say who exactly, I don't know. You know, it's just, it would be an assumption. So, anyway, the three friends have been demoralized, and so Elihu talks about the young, the very old. He's waited his turn. He says, I waited, I listened, and so he wants to bring Job to repentance. The three friends are very, very demoralized, so we don't hear anything more from them. They say nothing else in the book of Job. They become quiet. And so Elihu brings up this question. Well, if you three friends, Bildad, Zophar, and so forth, if you guys aren't going to say anything, should that keep me from speaking? Because I'm the youngest here. And he says, why should I not speak up? Basically is his attitude. He goes, I've waited. You guys aren't going to say anything else. You're the older, wiser men, but you have nothing else to say, so I'm going to speak up. He tells us in verses 17, 18, he's exercising his right to speak now. He says he was full of words, and he had to bring them forth. And he gives us a really good illustration or analogy. He uses the analogy of a wineskin, in which wine is inside of a wineskin, and as the wine ages and ferments, it builds up a gas. And if you don't put a vent in that wineskin, then it'll burst, and you'll lose the wineskin and the wine, of course. And so he gives us the example that he feels like he's building up so much inside that he's like a wineskin that needs to be vented. And if he doesn't do some venting, he's just going to break open. And so that's his analogy, so he needs to vent. Because he's been here apparently the whole time. And so he's heard the whole argument. And so he says in verse 20, to be relieved of pressure, he needed to be able to, as a young man, to speak freely. Now, he again says some things, I think, that are very mature in verses 21 and 22 at the end of chapter 32 here, is that he says, I promise to hold himself in an honorable fashion. So he's not going to give any flattering titles to Job or to the other three friends. He's not going to be a respecter of persons. And basically, what he's stating here is he wants to deal with just the facts. He goes, I'm not going to give anybody any flattery. I'm going to deal with just the facts. So some good things about Elihu, that he seems to appear very mature for his young age. So that's chapter 32. We're going to get into some more of this now in chapter 33. So if anybody has any questions, then we're going to move on. I'm going to have Kevin read chapter 33. It's a little bit longer. It's 33 verses. So thank you, Kevin.
Behold, no fear of me, he terrified you.
Okay. A couple of things to note as we get into chapter 33. Elihu is very polite, and he stops. And you'll find this tonight and next week. He'll pause and say, Job, do you have anything to say? So he shows some honor to Job, whereas the other three friends were just, you know, blasting away, making false. Elihu is somewhat of a gentleman for a young man, and he'll stop and say, Job, would you like to respond to anything? If not, then I'd like to continue to speak. So he's very polite in that regard. And he also shows, most of the commentaries I read on these chapters, Elihu shows really a lot of intelligence and wisdom for some areas that he talks about how God works to save people. And we're going to get into those right now. So how God reaches out to mankind. So at the start here, he says he's going to aim his words directly at Job. It's not to the three friends now. He wants to talk to Job himself. And later in chapter 34, he'll address the three friends. But right now, he wants to talk to Job. And Elihu asks Job, he wants Job to hear him to the end. He wants to hear him all that he has to say and to give heed to what he has to say. And again, I think there's some politeness here in verses 2 and 3. He assures Job that he will speak in the highest moral quality of his heart. He's going to speak sincerely. He's going to speak clearly. He will speak what he knows to be true and not with unfounded charges. That's an exact point against the three friends, because remember, they kept bringing up unfounded charges. Verse 4, basically, this is a repeat of chapter 32 and verse 8, that the Spirit made him and gave him life. He's not talking here as a young man about being inspired. He's basically saying his mental, his intellectual, and his physical life came from God, just like Job's mental and intellectual and physical life came from God as well. And so, in fact, he's going to try to do what we often tell people to do when you study with people, the gospel. You try to get on common ground with them. And that's what we're going to see him trying to do. He's trying to get on common ground with Job here. And so, in verse 5, he's urging Job to defend himself as an intellectual. Thus, a meeting of two intellects with common origins on equal ground. And so he's trying to put himself on equal ground with Job. And the very next verse really talks about that. He says, I am just a man before God, just like you are. And then he goes in, he says, both of us were formed of clay. Both of us have a common relationship with God. Both of us came from the same source. And so, again, Elihu is putting himself, or trying to put himself, on an equal ground, saying, Job, you know, I'm not your superior. You and I are on equal ground. We are both beings that have been created by God. And so, again, he shows a little politeness in verse 7. He states that he's not going to exert any undue pressure upon Job, nor press his point too heavily. He's going to strive, again, for fairness. Now, here's where he gets in, where he starts picking Job's words apart. He doesn't make false assumptions. He has been there the whole time. And so he starts referring back, and I've put these in your handouts of the previous things that Job stated. And he said, in verses 8 and 9, he says, I heard you, Job, and you said earlier, and this is in chapter 9:21, that I am perfect. And in chapter 13 and verse 18, that I am righteous. And then in chapter 23 and verse 10, that when I stand before God, I'm going to come forth as gold. And so he's not trumping up charges like the other three friends did. He's charging Job according to his own words. He's saying, this is where I'm going to talk to you about this, Job, because I don't think you were right in this. Verses 10 and 11, he also heard Job say that he was not wicked in chapter 10 and verse 7, and that God held him as an enemy in chapter 13, 24, and in 19:11. And the might of his hand, God was persecuting Job. And Job referred to that in chapter 30 and 21. So again, he's pointing that out, that he's been here, he's heard the whole conversation, and so he's referring back to all these statements Job made at times when Job was really unfairly talking about God. And so that's where he's going to attack Job. He's not going to make false trumped-up charges. So in verse 12, he says, in these things, he's going to answer Job. Job was not being just towards God. Job was assuming all this was from God's hand, and this was wrong. Now, we have to, again, take a sidestep. as people on the inside reading this by inspiration of the Holy Ghost, we know that there's other people involved. We know Satan's involved. And we know all these things were done in a test to Job. But Job isn't privy to any of this knowledge. And so Job keeps, you know, early you might recall, he said, if this is not from God, who is all this from? And so Elihu feels he's wrong in that. And then Elihu takes a sidestep and starts talking about, well, Job, let me tell you how God speaks to man. A lot of wisdom here, because this is fairly accurate. He says there's three ways that God talks to mankind, and one of them is in dreams, another one is through sufferings, and another one is in a messenger or an angel from God. And so the point he's trying to make is God really is under no obligation to give an account for his ways, nor to answer any of Job's questions regarding his actions of will. God had spoken to Job. Job hadn't recognized the lesson. So now he's focusing, saying, Job, God has talked to you. And it was one of these three things. Guess which one it was, Job? It wasn't a dream and it wasn't a messenger. It was in sufferings. And that's how God has been talking to you. And so, but he's going to go through and elaborate on each of these three avenues. And so in verse 15, he says, well, first of all, God speaks to us in dreams. And this is true. We can read this in our Old Testament. Many, many times throughout history, God reveals his dreams through various men. Abimelech, back in Genesis 20. Jacob, in Genesis 31. Laban, in Genesis 31. Pharaoh, in Genesis 41. Nebuchadnezzar, in Daniel, chapters 4 and chapter 2. And so he's saying, you know, this is one of the ways that, Job, that God speaks to us, is in dreams. And he says, God opens or uncovers the ear, and God seals or guarantees the authenticity of that message that's in a dream. He goes on here in verse 17. He says, the message from God in dreams may come as a warning that a man should basically change his course or his way. In so doing, God would hide that pride, that man's pride, and keep a soul from the pit. And that usually refers to death or Sheol or the grave. And so that's his commentary on dreams. Well, then he goes on to the next one, which he thinks is the one that applies to Job. He says, God sometimes talked to us by giving us suffering. And this is the one he thinks that Job hasn't recognized, that God is trying to tell you something, Job, and it's through your suffering. And he says, so the second way God speaks is through suffering and through chastisement. And his point basically, and as you read through 19 and 20, is that God sometimes will correct us with pain that's so severe it will confine us. He talks about bones having pain. He talks about the appetite is completely gone. He says that food is no longer desired. And so a person is basically suffering a lot here. And although Elihu is speaking in generalities of verse 21, it seems to describe Job and his condition. Job had his flesh consumed, as we know. His bones were showing. You might remember earlier Job made the statement, his collar he could wrap around his neck. He was basically skin and bones. And you might also recall Job said he burned with pain. His bones burned with pain, probably a fever. And that's the same thing that Elihu refers to, is that his flesh was consumed, bones will be showing, and his bones might burn with pain. The point he's trying to make is Job's punishment, Job, is not for sin, like the three friends had assumed. God was trying to teach you something. God was trying to teach you through something, through discipline. So he takes a completely different approach than just trumping up charges. He says, Job, you haven't seen the big picture. God's trying to tell you something. I don't know what it is, but he's trying to tell you something. So interesting approach. Very, very interesting. And it's very mature for someone as young as he is. Verse 22, he makes the statement that sometimes God, in bringing suffering to someone, sometimes even brings them to the very brink of death. And this certainly, in Job's ears, is probably what Job thinks is happening. Job thinks he's going to die. And so that's the situation here. Dave.
No, I'm just thinking back in 19 and 20 here, and the point he was making with regards to being in pain, the appetite is gone, food is not desired. Those are the very things that happen when sin is present and you have a reckoning with that sin. Those, when you really get give it a lot of thought, those are the things that come about as a result. Those very things.
Uh-huh.
You don't feel hungry. You have that. The food's just not desired. Your appetite's gone, and you're in pain. And so, it can be attributed to sin. But here, you know, he's attributing it that God is using this for another reason to teach him a lesson. But those are the same exact things that happen when sin is present.
Absolutely. And I appreciate, honestly, it's kind of refreshing to see Elihu's approach. I'm not saying he's perfect and he has all the right answers, but his approach is much better, I think, than the three friends. And Job certainly has stated he thinks he's going to die, too. And so that fits in verse 22. He says it may bring a person to the brink of death. Donna.
But God does use adversity to make us stronger.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So
and it may be because of consequences from sin, of somebody else's sin sometimes. So, but surprisingly, Elihu's pretty dead on these three avenues. And we're going to go to the third one here in just a second. But in fact, the third one is God speaks to us. And we see this a lot in the Old Testament through messengers or angels. The Hebrew word angel basically means messenger or angel of Jehovah. And it's interesting, Elihu even makes reference here that if there is a messenger, and I'm in verse 23, a mediator, one among a thousand. So his point here, commentary thinks what he's saying is that sometimes God speaks directly to men, but it only happens one in a thousand times. It seems to be what his reference. In other words, during that age, God didn't just speak to everybody. It was just one in a thousand. It seems to be what he's saying. A messenger that when he does talk to a man, he tells him what is right for him and the right thing for him to do. And so these are the three avenues: dreams, sufferings, and a messenger. So that's what Elihu is stating, how God works. Verse 24, he says, God is gracious. So whether it's through a dream or suffering or through an angel, God's intent is to save mankind from the pit. And very interesting, he uses the word ransom. And of course, we know in the New Testament, our ransom, the ransom that was paid for us, was Jesus Christ. And so he makes reference in verse 24 of the idea of having a ransom. He says, you know, about delivering someone down to the pit, and I have found a ransom. And we know that ransom is nothing that we could pay for ourselves. We cannot save ourselves. That ransom's got to be acceptable to God, and mankind cannot provide it for himself. So he makes an allusion to ransom, which I find also very interesting, because we know that Jesus is our ransom. He kind of starts summing up. He says, if a man listens, verse 25, to God, his health and his vigor will be restored. And not only that, verse 26, the right relationship between God and the sinner is now restored. And so the whole idea here he's leading up to is that there's going to be a reconciliation between man and God. And the idea is a person who's been corrected by God, whether through a dream or through sufferings or the messenger, will be redeemed. He's confessed whatever sin that caused this. He's repented to God. And whatever the sinful man has gotten by perverting the right way was not equal to what it cost him in his sufferings. But being redeemed, he now holds the light of life. And so he's basically alluding that there's sin in Job's life, but he's not doing like the other three friends and just making accusations. He's saying, Job, this happened, the suffering you're going through, is there's something in your life. Don't know what it is, but there's something in your life. And so he's alluding to some kind of sin, and whatever it is, Job needs to repent of it, and then he'll be back in that right relationship with God again. So much more pleasant conversation with Elihu. Verses 29 and 30, he says, these are the works of God. So he's summing up again. This is how God works through dreams, through sufferings, through messengers, and that God uses these over and over and over again to save mankind from the pit. He now again takes a sidestep in verses 31 and 33. He's got more to say, but he again, as I said, he pauses and gives Job a chance to respond. And he you know, asked Job, is there something you want to say? And if not, then I have more to say. And so he takes a sidestep here and then asks Job if there's anything he wants to speak. And there's no answer from Job, so he's now going to proceed on some more. I put a little note here at the bottom, and this is what several of the commentaries, Anderson and Homer Haley and others, Eliot, have said, that Elihu, for being a young man, seems to reveal much more profound knowledge on the subject of suffering than either Job or his friends. And he also points, maybe knowing or not knowing, to the solution for man's redemption, and that is man needed a ransom. And so I find that very interesting. Okay, BJ and then Donna.
Well, there's a lot more messianic speech in here than just the idea of a ransom. You know, when you look through here, someone who is a mediator, who delivers me from death, who restores man to righteousness, who redeems his soul from death, and then in turn we look upon the light. I mean, this whole section is very messianic.
Yep.
There's a lot of times where men spoke without realizing in ways that would later be fulfilled in Jesus Christ. And I think this is one of those cases where Jesus Christ will, in essence, fulfill these words of Elihu, but in a way that Elihu didn't realize he was speaking about, and in a way that none of his hearers realized he was speaking about.
And we have the advantage of being way ahead and looking back and knowing all things that have transpired. And yeah, I think BJ's dead on that. There's a lot, we could go a lot deeper in this. We just don't have the time to go into all of it. Donna? Right.
But to them, he's still in that mindset.
Yes.
Type of thing.
Yes. And like I say, Elihu's a lot more polite, though. He says, I'm not going to accuse you of anything, Job. I'm just telling you you're suffering, and there's a reason you're suffering. There's something out of whack. Something out of whack with your relationship to God. And so he's trying to be very polite about it. Okay, let's. We've only got about 12 minutes. We're going to get through chapter 34 here. So chapter 34, he's going to continue, and so he takes a break, and then he says, okay, Job, you don't have anything to say, so I'm going to speak some more. And this is Elihu's, what they call his second speech. He says in verses 1 through 4, he talks about the fact that the ear is a part of our body that tries words, and he refers to the palate, your mouth tries food. And he says, therefore, we need to, as a person who hears and tries food and tries words, we need to choose and know what is right and know what is good. So he actually gets in now verses 5 through 9 of chapter 34 here, that he's basically accusing Job, and I say accusing, he's suggesting that Job has displayed some irreverence or scoffing towards God. And that is somewhat true. Job earlier many times laid the blame of all his things at the feet of God because he didn't know who else to it could be. And he goes back to again reminding Job of some things he had said earlier. Verses 5 and 6, he reminds the wise men that were still standing there that Job had claimed he was righteous, chapter 13, verse 18. And that when God would try him, he would come forth like gold, chapter 23 and verse 10. Job had claimed he had not received a fair and proper trial, and therefore Elihu implies that from these statements that Job claimed that God had branded him a liar. So he's saying, Job, you've made some false statements about God and about the way God works. And that's where he's going to attack now, is that you have said unfair things about God. And the other thing he charges Job in verses 7 and 8, he talks about Job scoffing like water. And that's really kind of a difficult passage, the translator said. But to scoff at somebody in the Old Testament was to mock them or to deride them. And that's what he's saying, is he felt Job at times had been mocking God, which would have been blasphemy. Elihu asked Job, why would he be keeping company with such evil men and walk with them? Why would you act like a really truly evil man by scoffing or mocking God? His view is that some of the things he laid at God's feet were unfair, and he's going to pinpoint now on that. He says in verse 9, the implication here is that Job stands in the same class with wicked men. He's trying, basically, again, he goes back to Job's earlier words and repeats that over and over again. Verse 10, from Elihu's view, some of Job's comments left God in a very unfavorable light, and therefore he, Elihu, is going to defend God, as if that's his right. But he tries to point out here in verse 10 of chapter 34 that God would not do wickedness. God would not commit iniquity ever. And others had made statements along this line too. Abraham talks in Genesis 18 that God would never do wickedness or commit iniquity. Moses says the same thing in Deuteronomy 32. Jehoshaphat says the same thing in 2 Chronicles 19. And so Elihu's point is, Job, you've assumed all these calamities are from God, and they are not from God. That's really what he's trying to summarize here. Verse 11, he seems to be pointing out that sometimes the consequence of an act may be from God, but the event or the act itself will not be. Kind of drawing, splitting hairs here, but he's trying to say God wasn't directly the person causing you to have all this suffering. There's something else involved here. In verse 12, there appears to be a rebuke of Job's statement back in chapter 9, and he's just basically saying whatever God does is never a perversion of justice. Job in chapter 9 had said that perhaps there, you know, he hasn't been treated fairly in a court of law, and Elihu's saying no, God would never pervert justice. That's not how God operates. He says some very, very intelligent things here in these chapters. Verse 13. He's going to set forth proof of God's sovereignty here. He talks about how all things were created and placed where they are by himself, by the Almighty, the things that were not given to him, but rather everything belongs to God. By the inherent right of the Godhead, he created everything. And therefore, his point is, Job, God is not answerable to anybody, especially you. Okay, God is not answerable to anybody but himself. And that's what he seems to be trying to say in verse 13 here. He goes on with this majestic overview of God's power. Verses 14 and 15, he says not only is the whole of creation under God's control, but all life is dependent upon him. All creation exists by the breath of his mouth. And that's Psalm 33. And what he's trying to point out here is that God, what God does with his creation is his right and cannot be questioned. We've often read that passage in the Old Testament about God is displayed as the potter and we are the clay. And we have no right to ask God, the potter, why did you make me thus? And so that seems to be what he's saying, is that we have no right to question God about anything. And so his other point is that man should not complain or blame God for the consequences that come as a result of our own actions, but rather man should correct his actions that brought on whatever the dire consequences are. And so again, there seems to be an illusion that, Job, there's something out of whack in your life. You are not right with God in some area, and that's why all these calamities have befallen you. Verse 16, he appeals to wise men or men of understanding. Apparently he's talking still to Job and the three friends. He wants them to continue to listen to him. And so again, he's taking a little bit of a sidestep. Please let me continue. Let me finish my dialogue here. Verse 17, he quotes and talks about some of Job's earlier words. He says they were harsh from chapter 33 and 34. And also he felt that Job had questioned the moral government within the universe, that God wasn't entirely involved in moral government, or perhaps God just didn't care. And his point here is that Job's words had been inconsistent with the character of God, and who would never do wickedly, God would never pervert justice. And so this is where Elihu felt Job had done wrong and he needed to be corrected. He had laid some things at God's feet that weren't correct. He again goes back into some dialogue in verses 18 and 19. He talks about how the fact that God judges nations, God judges individuals without partiality. God acts upon the principle of impartiality, and he wants Job to recognize that God is impartial. Verse 20, he makes an allusion to death, and death, as we know, is the great equalizer. No matter how mighty a man might become or how much rule a man might have in this world, death is the great equalizer. Even the mighty who have wielded great power in this life and on this earth over other people, they will be taken down by the great equalizer, and that's death. Verses 21 and 22, he's describing God's omniscience. Basically what he's saying is nothing, Job, is ever concealed from God's eyes. God knows what's happened to you, and of course God does know, and that there's really no place a man can hide. God sees it all. And there's a really great passage in Psalms 139, which I put in there for you, where the psalmist writes, "Where can I go from God's presence? If I go to the depths of the ocean, you are there. If I go to the heavens, you are there." You know, there's no place a man can go to escape the presence of God. God is omnipresent and omniscient, and God is there. There's no hiding from God. You cannot escape God's presence. He moves on a little bit more. You might recall earlier that Job continually kept saying, I want to go into a courtroom, and I want a mediator, and I want to be able to have someone represent my case, and that when my case is presented, I'll be found innocent, and I'll come forth like gold. You might remember all those statements. Well, Elihu's response to all of that is really, Job, there's no need for a judicial investigation, because God already knows everything that's happened. And he knows man's character, man's thoughts, man's deeds, and God acts on that with perfect knowledge. So he's saying, Job, there's no need for any kind of a judicial investigation. God already knows your situation, whatever it is. And another, I think, very good point from this young man. He goes on with God's power in verse 24. He says, God breaks in pieces, he crushes, he destroys the great and the mighty man. He brings them to an end. And that God knows us, every one of us, in ways that are past finding out. And that's true. God does know us in ways that we just don't know. In verse 25, he talks that God clearly sees the character and the works of the mighty. And this is talking about mighty men that are evil. And he overthrows them and their works altogether. He starts wrapping up here in verses 26, 27, and 28. He says, the mighty do their deeds in darkness, thinking that they are hidden. God sees all. God strikes them down in the sight of others. And when wicked men turn aside from God, they will also sometimes afflict the poor, and causing the poor to cry out their affliction to the ears of God. 29 and 30, he talks about tranquility and quietness. And the reference seems to be here that what he's talking about is that tranquility and quietness is brought about after God crushes the wicked. Who can condemn if this is from God? God's hiding his face was a mark of displeasure with an individual or with a nation. But the reference here seems to be that once God takes action, tranquility and quietness is brought forth. Verses 31 and 32, Elihu here insinuates that one who has suffered such for correction or discipline, like Job, should confess his wrongdoing for what he is being corrected for and vow to do such no more. So again, he's referring to Job. You've suffered. There's got to be something. There's got to be something. Verse 33, and he says, if this happens in this covenant of peace between a sinner and God, when their restored relationship happens, who gets to determine the terms, Job? So he's asking Job, you know, Job, you've been wanting a courtroom session. You've been wanting a judicial review. And he says, you need to remind yourself, Job, who God is. Who determines the terms between the maker and the makee? And he says, is it you? What do you think, Job? And of course, the answer is God determines the terms. And so he's kind of dressing Job down a little bit here, that you don't have a right to question God on anything. You know, God determines the terms. Verses 34 and 35, he says, men or wise men that have heard Elihu's speech, seems to be a reference to the other three, and Job, will conclude that Job had spoken without knowledge or wisdom. And ironically, that's one of the first things that God says when he appears in a couple weeks. We'll talk, when God appears out of the whirlwind in chapter 38, he says those exact words, who has spoken without knowledge and without wisdom. So Elihu again shows some very keen insights here. Last slide I have here for tonight, and then we'll let the young ones in here. In verses 36 and 37, Elihu wanted Job tested. He wanted Job proved, and he wanted Job tried to the very end. And ironically, these are the three things that are confirmed by God later on. God does try Job to the end. And also, his charge that Job answered like a wicked man was correct. Job had said some wrong things about God, and that was correct. And also that he says when Job was tried, that Job would come forth as gold, and that is also correct. Job is exonerated. In fact, Job is the one who has to pray for the others. In verse 37, he levels basically his three charges that he can find against Job. He feels that Job has been rebellious in his words that he has said previously. And the other thing, which is I had to do some reading on this, that Job has clapped his hands. And I guess in the Old Testament, when you were listening to somebody and you didn't want to hear anymore, you just clapped your hands and that was it. You're not going to pay attention anymore. And Job has clapped his hands, basically saying, I'm done. I'm not listening to you. And so Job had been repudiating their wisdom. And the other accusation is Job had multiplied his words, he felt, against God. And so those were Elihu's charges to Job. And finally, in conclusion, Job had pointed out three things. He had pointed to God's just and righteous use of power, and that's certainly valid. He pointed to God's just and impartial judgments, and that's certainly true. And he pointed to God's omniscience and omnipresence, and that is true too. We're left at the end of chapter 34. Job does not respond, so all is still quiet. So when BJ picks up next week, you're going to see again Elihu, taking the stance and saying, do you have anything to say, Job? And then he starts back in again, and he will then go through 35, 36, and 37. And then that is the break, and then God comes on the scene. So BJ will cover that next week. Any final parting thoughts or questions? Well, thank you very much for your comments, and we'll catch you next time.